It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Coming up later in the program, we'll be taking your calls about your favorite Christmas movie or TV special, or your least favorite. We really don't care. Either way is fine. If you want to get in line for that, you can reach us at 800-642-1234. You'll have to hold for a while, but it won't be that long. Or talk@WPR.org. You can email us there.
And one of the favorites that a lot of people point to is A Christmas Carol. It's been 170 years since Charles Dickens wrote his novella, A Christmas Carol. And since that time, it's been a source of lots and lots of adaptations, and it's been inspiration for lots of other things as well. But what is it about the story that keeps us coming back time and time again?
Well, here to explain its enduring popularity of A Christmas Carol is Naomi Wood. She's a professor of English at Kansas State University. Naomi, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So what's the deal with The Christmas Carol? Why do people like it so much?
I think it has the perfect combination of dramatic aspects and what I would call archetypal aspects. You have memorable taglines like Bah Humbug and God Bless Us Everyone. And that combination of astringency and sentimentality, I think, is one of the things that makes people keep coming back to it.
Do you think it also has a kind of an anti-commercialism message as well?
Absolutely. Even though it also encourages celebration and buying luxury items like meat and having parties and things like that, but it is definitely about getting together with people rather than simply spending a lot of money on gifts.
And also there's sort of a relatable aspect. I think everybody at some point in their life feels like they're a little bit like Scrooge, don't they?
Absolutely. I think when the holiday making gets too excessive, Scrooge often is refreshing, right? He just says, bah, humbug, I don't want to get involved with this. But I think we all use things, money especially, to guard against hurt and disappointment. And I think Scrooge's case demonstrates that the bitterest and most cynical people are sometimes disappointed idealists.
How do you understand the three ghosts that visit Scrooge? How would we look at them today?
I see them as metaphors for memory and for conscience. The ghost of Christmas past forces Scrooge to look back on Christmases that he had experienced and to reflect on how he had gotten to be the way he was. And then the ghosts of Christmas present caused him to look beyond his own limited, grasping point of view. And then Christmas yet to come, I think, is almost conscience. It's saying, what do I want my legacy to be? What do I want people to remember me for?
And so Scrooge, I mean, basically, A Christmas Carol actually allows people to sort of understand they have control over their future in some way or another. Was that unusual compared to other things that were coming out around that time?
Yeah, I think fairly unusual. It was in the early stages of the Industrial Revolution in England, and it was still news for people to think about themselves as having a hand in the kind of person they might become. But definitely Dickens believed in that with all his heart and felt that you could act to better yourself and to better your community in very tangible ways.
There have been a lot of spinoffs of A Christmas Carol, updates and all kinds of things. Do you have any favorites?
This is going to sound funny, but I like Blackadder's Christmas Carol, which is sort of the opposite of everything I've been saying.
I don't know that one.
Well, it's the Rowan Atkinson character who plays Mr. Bean. He has a kind of parodic English literature history series that that upends a lot of the cliches. And his Christmas Carol features a good charitable man who discovers that his ancestors were high livers, even though they were very bad, and he converts to being a bad man as a result of the visit from the ghost.
Oh,
but,
that's horrible.
Okay. Well, it's very funny, that's the thing, because it's not pious the way that some of the more saccharine adaptations work. And I think that's what I like about it. But I'd say in terms of straight adaptations, I like the George C. Scott one. I think it's a lot of fun.
And the thing about A Christmas Carol is there is sort of like the sense of redemption. I mean, it sort of fits in very well with the holiday of Christmas or the traditional holiday of Christmas, wouldn't you say?
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a way for people to refocus and stand back from the hullabaloo of whatever they're usually worried about and say, hey, there's people around me. I can celebrate. It's a time of light and festivity, and we should value these moments as they come because they're fleeting.
Do you think there will ever come a time when A Christmas Carol doesn't feel relevant and fresh anymore, or is it something that's pretty evergreen for the ages?
Oh, I would hate to say that it's going to be around in 1,000 years, but I don't see it going away anytime soon. As long as the conditions that produce misers and poor people and inequality and the need for grace exist, I think we're going to need this story.
There have been so many different adaptations and stuff, and I think I read something where you may have been quoted as saying that if Charles Dickens were alive today, first off, he'd be really old, but secondly, he'd appreciate the fact that people have adapted the story so much. And actually, that was something that he enjoyed even when he was alive, right?
Yeah, he loved the theater, and I think if he had lived now, he would have been a movie maker. He just has a very cinematic eye. And he's very visual. I think he would love to do his own adaptations. In fact, he did his own adaptations for performing. He would read them aloud for audiences, even in his own lifetime. So I think he would be very intrigued and interested in all of the different adaptations that are around today.
In terms of another aspect of this, it seems like the quintessential Christmas is often shown as an English Christmas within an English village and, you know, the English carolers, little choir boys, and you often see that in A Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm. Is that part of why this endures? Because it's basically a depiction of an English Christmas.
Yeah, I think not only that it's an English Christmas, but they managed to capture the things that make a winter celebration perfect, right? The lights, the song, defying the dark, defying the cold, gathering together, the coziness of a feast with drinks and food and all the things that make for a good celebration. So I think Dickens and other people like him in the 1800s, did a very nice job of packaging Christmas so that it could be a great celebration for a lot of different kinds of people.
Well, Naomi Wood, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Naomi Wood is a professor of English at Kansas State University. She spoke to us about A Christmas Carol and its enduring appeal.
After the break, we'll be taking your calls. And what we want to know is, what is your favorite Christmas movie or TV special of all time? What are you going to be watching with your family this Christmas? And if you've got a favorite adaptation of A Christmas Carol, we'd be curious to hear about that as well. Mike also said, what is your least favorite? What do you turn off the minute it comes on? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll get to your calls and comments right after the news.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're taking your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. We're wondering what your favorite Christmas movie or TV special of all time is. This is a time when lots of folks gather with their families around the TV and pull out those old DVDs or hope to catch a rerun of their favorites. Well, what are your favorites? What really says Christmas to you? Maybe there's one you can't stand. You can let us know about that as well. 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to the phones first and take Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Don't tell me. I just got done with my Christmas cookies. the movie I hate the most is It's a Wonderful Life, but the movie I really love is The Christmas Story. I don't know why. I just everyone all bought the DVD so I can watch it when it's not Christmas.
So you hate It's a Wonderful Life. Why?
I absolutely hate it.
What was that?
I absolutely hate it. I guess it just, I don't know, it's just, I don't believe in, you know, having somebody finding that great of a life and stuff. And I've had a rough Christmas. My mom died during Christmas, so I'm not a big Christmas person anymore.
Okay. So a Christmas Story, though, you like?
Oh, I love, yeah. I went and bought it on DVD. Like, I refuse to go to my mother-in-law's house because she hates the movie and she won't let me watch it, so.
Well, let's listen to a little snippet from that. Thanks a lot for your call, Nick.
No, no, I want an official red undercover knife. Shoot you in a jet with my leg rifle.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas. Ho, ho, ho.
You will shoot your eye out, kid. If you saw that movie, you know that that's a big part of it. He wants a BB gun for Christmas. He gets it. He shoots his eye out. Not entirely, but partially.
Spoiler alert. Alert there, Mike.
Oh, sorry. Oops. Oops. Never mind. 800-642-1234 is a number. We're having people call in and tell us what they enjoy for the Christmas. For the Christmas.
Anyway.
Sorry about that.
For the Christmas.
Yes,
all right. Well, thank
for the
you.
Christmas,
thank
for
you,
the
Nick,
holidays.
For that call. We appreciate that.
Yeah. So let's go to Katie in Green Bay. What do you like to watch around the holidays, Katie?
Hi, Mike and Veronica. Merry Christmas to you.
And you too. What do you think?
So
what do you vote for?
I love A Muppet Christmas Carol. I was an English major in college and a lifelong Anglophile and just love Christmas and the Muppets just bring whimsy and joy.
So who's Scrooge in that?
Michael Caine, who's just phenomenal. Oh. He's so wonderful. His transformation is just delightful. He's so crotchety in the beginning, and then he's got the twinkle in his eye by the end, and to see him surrounded by the Muppets assemblage at the very end is really heartwarming.
That's fantastic, Katie. Thank you. I actually am going to take your suggestion on that one. I think my kids might like that one. That's one that sort of slipped away over the years, so it's fun to remember them again. We don't have a clip of that one, but thank you for reminding us about Muppet Christmas Carol. That's fun. And we move next to Irene in Phillips. Hi, Irene.
Hi, good evening.
Hello.
First of all, I have to echo what one of the previous callers said. He doesn't care for It's a Wonderful Life anymore, and neither do I. I shut it off the other night. It just got to be too heavy. And I love the Christmas Story. In fact, my daughter in Nevada has a leg lamp, and she sent my husband and me a leg lamp a few years ago. And it's amazing. I live on a main thoroughfare out of Phillips, and most people know what it's about, and some people are scratching their heads wondering, what is a leg lamp doing in the window? So that's my favorite thing. My next favorite movie, though, would be National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I think that's also a delightful thing to watch during the holidays.
And we happen to have a clip of that one, the National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Let's take a listen.
You see, kids, this is what our forefathers did.
I can't feel my leg.
They walked out into the woods, they picked out that special tree, and they cut it down with their bare hands.
Mom, I can't feel my hips. Clark.
Yes, honey.
Audrey's frozen from the waist down.
That's all part of the experience, honey.
Oh, I haven't seen that in a while either. Those sound fun. Irene, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
I got to ask you, because it's a theme now, why do you not like It's a Wonderful Life?
I've seen it quite a few times, and it's just getting to be too much. Although I can watch these other two many, many more times, I think, before I get sick of them.
Is it because you think George Bailey's kind of a jerk, or what?
Oh, no, he was a really nice guy, but it just seems too serious if you want to get into a lighthearted mood during Christmas.
That makes sense. Well, thanks for calling.
That's my feeling. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Now, we need to go to another. I have to admit, I kind of like It's a Wonderful Life myself, so we need to give equal time to that movie. Let's go to Deborah in Milwaukee. Can you help us out here?
Yes.
You like It's a Wonderful Life?
Yes, that's my favorite all-time movie, Christmas movie. I watch it every year and look forward to having it come on.
So a number of people have said they don't like that movie because it's too heavy. Could you make a case for why someone should watch It's a Wonderful Life around the holidays?
It's down to earth and it talks about, what the meaning of Christmas really is all about to me.
It's definitely a classic, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And it does sort of, I mean, there's something, a lot of those other clips that we've heard, they're wonderful, but A Christmas Story and A Christmas Vacation with Chevy Chase, those are ironic Christmas movies. And It's a Wonderful Life, that is a sincere movie. They really believe that message about Christmas, or at least that's what comes across, that this is very sincere. And I think that's something that will speak to you if you're in the right kind of mood.
Now, Deborah, when was the first time you saw the movie?
Probably 6 years ago. It was my grandma Doris. Before she passed away, we used to watch it every year together. So I kind of make it a tradition to watch that every year from now on.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks for calling in, Deborah. We really appreciate it. And it's good to have somebody who's supporting It's a Wonderful Life. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. If you want to call in and let us know what we should be watching around the holidays, we'd love to hear from you. Again, the number 800-642-1234. And let's go to Deanna from Renshaw, Minnesota. Deanna?
Hi.
What's your favorite movie around the holidays?
My favorite movie is The Waltons' Homecoming. I love It's a Wonderful Life, though. I just had to plug that. But I just love a homecoming, The Homecoming.
Was that a movie or a TV special?
It was a movie before they made the TV show.
Okay.
It was Patricia Neal was the mom. Otherwise, the kids were all the same as were in the TV show, and the grandma. But the dad and the grandpa were different actors.
Do they turn out the lights at the end like they did on The Waltons?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they do. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an awesome movie. It's like maybe an hour and a half at the most. It's very sweet.
And so basically it's focused on Depression-era Virginia or something like that?
Yes. Yep.
That's a good suggestion. That's kind of obscure. So thanks for calling that one in, Deanna.
Thank
we appreciate
you so much.
It. Thanks for listening. Let's move on to another one. Jessica from Green Bay. Jessica, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
And what's your holiday movie that you like to watch?
My favorite one is actually, I don't really think that it's considered necessarily a holiday movie, or Christmas movie, but it is, the sole basis of it is based around Christmas and family tradition, and it's about a family who, they are very tight-knit, and the mother ends up getting cancer, and it's a really good heartfelt, it's all about family and about the holidays and what Christmas is really about.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I've seen that one. It slipped my memory, but yeah, that is it's another heartfelt one. It is a bit of a tearjerker, but it's about family. So thank you so much, Jessica, for that. Appreciate the call. And let's listen to a clip from another one. This is another classic through the ages.
Just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed.
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Of course, a clip there from a Charlie Brown Christmas. I'm sorry I had to play that, Mike. I know that's traumatic for you.
It makes me sad.
Are you crying now?
It's like me with other people said that It's a Wonderful Life does that for them, but for some reason or another, the Charlie Brown Christmas just really makes me sad.
It is. Well, they talked about the depression right there, and sometimes the holidays and depression go hand in hand. So it's melancholy. That's what I think about the Charlie Brown Christmas. Let us know what you think about that one, because that's another classic like A Wonderful Life that people have strong feelings about. And let's go next to Terry in Paoli. Hi, Terry.
Hi,
what do you think?
Well, my favorite is The Bishop's Wife.
What's that movie
about? With Cary Grant. Not sure if you're familiar with that. I love it because Cary Grant is an angel that comes down around Christmas time and links himself into this family of a bishop.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, I remember
that. Everyone that meets him is so charmed by him. And I just always wanted to be him. You know?
You always wanted to be Cary Grant as an angel?
I'm sorry. A female version. You know, what can I say? I wanted to be that angel that was down on earth making everybody feel better about themselves.
That's a good aspiration to have.
Yeah.
So do you try to do that around the holidays? You try to be as nice as possible to people?
I try to do it all around the year.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, all around the year. But no. I mean, there are so many others, like Miracle on 34th Street, and I mean, there are so many. But that is one where I just always wished that if I could, I would love to be in real life. I would love to be that Cary Grant angel.
Well, thank you so much for that. That's a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for that call, Terry. And thank you to everyone who called and shared your suggestions and your thoughts about It's a Wonderful Life and lots of others. Appreciate those. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what you look forward to, what you can't stand, and maybe why you love what you love at Christmas time.
Coming up next, a Madison-based pastor says the city is failing its African-American community, and he'd like to see that change. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in today for Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Last week, Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison wrote an article in the Capital Times. In the article, he says, despite Madison's identity as a liberal or progressive place, Wisconsin's capital fails its African-American community in numerous ways.
Today, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy also released a report on the, quote, vast chasm separating Wisconsin's African-American and white economic outcomes. It's across the state, noting that Wisconsin ranks second in the nation for economic disparity between blacks and whites. We've invited Reverend Alex G. to join us to discuss a situation that he's witnessed in Madison. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure being here.
Now, why did you write the article in the first place? It almost feels like, you know, with 12-step programs, you have to know you have a problem to get started. Was that sort of part of what you were doing in writing this article?
Well, I think so. I've noticed a few things that if you're not indigenous to Madison, you're not really allowed to speak out against Madison. And if you're from Madison and you're doing fairly well, it's difficult to speak out because people ask, well, how can you complain? You're living a good life and you benefit from this community. And so I've straddled the fence for a number of years. But after personal experiences, just mounting up over the years, I just decided that if I don't lend my voice as a person who is indigenous to this community, then the subject matter of profiling, of mass incarceration, et cetera, would have little or no credibility. So I wrote it so that I would not betray my South Madison community where I grew up and where I know on a daily basis. People experience the things that I do.
And so in one of the points you make is that even though Madison's seen as sort of a progressive and open place, it's not as welcoming and open to African Americans in a lot of ways.
Exactly. And I tried to balance the article by showing that I'm very proud to be Madisonian, that my family's been here for 45 years. And what I really said is I want the Madisonian atmosphere that my family felt in 1970, where we weren't stigmatized by being from the west side of Chicago. We weren't viewed with suspicion that we were here for better welfare benefits or to bring crime or to bring down the graduation or the performance of students of color. I felt that the community was very affirming. My mom received 2 degrees from the University of Wisconsin, and she never went to high school. And she was on the dean's list in grad school, and she sent both my sister, Laleda, and I to the university, and we both graduated. But it seems like things have changed over the years, that we've become hoarders and we're afraid that outsiders are coming to take our city away from us. And I feel that it's much different than it was when I was a kid and the total minority population was probably less than 1%. So I wrote it to help Madison remember its roots and not live in its rearview mirror by remembering, you know, the days of the protests over the Vietnam War or sitting in for the Black Student Union or the Black Studies program. I think we if we're not careful, we live so much in our rearview mirror that we think we have no responsibility to make things fair today. And I just wrote that because I wanted to help the community to have a healthy checkup.
Now, you mentioned the difference between the 1970s and now. That actually was something that was pointed out in the report that was done by the Center for Wisconsin Strategy, too, where they said that things are much different in Wisconsin now than they were in the 1970s. You kind of touched on that, but what do you think some of the issues are? Do you think it is sort of this don't come into Wisconsin kind of thing going on? Or
I think that that's part of it. I remember when there was talk in the mid-90s about welfare reform. the word on the street, the discussion was that we were too attractive to outside individuals who were moving here because we were paying our poor people so well that that they were coming to Wisconsin so that they could make it big and become middle class. I'm being facetious. And so, but I feel that the numbers were so small in the 70s, it wasn't perceived as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
We were still a novelty. I could go 3 days without seeing someone who looked like me. I've only had 2 African-American teachers from second grade through my graduation from high school. However, there was an openness even to the kids who attended Leopold Elementary School but lived on farms in Fitchburg. There was still an openness and acceptance. I feel something shifted. It's more combative. It just feels different, and it feels like everyone's vying for the same piece of pie. Therefore, they're being suspicious and not as welcoming to the new kids in the block.
So do you think some of that has to do with political discussions that have happened in the state, or do you think there's more to it than that?
I think that the political discussions are part of it, but I think it just goes way back. I think when the populations began to increase and the demographics changed, and it became apparent that Madison's different. I noticed from 1980 to 1990, the African-American population in Madison doubled. Well, no one saw that coming. And then when you have increased numbers, you have increased demand. So you're wondering, well, where are the African-American police officers and librarians and mail carriers and administrators in schools? And so I suppose the broader community thought it's never been a problem up till now. Our teachers have taught everyone. So now you want inclusive curriculum and you want Black history and you want Black teachers teaching Black history. And I think just when the African-American community was being able to use the homeowners' towels, the city put the guest towels back out. And so there was a sense that you're not really from here. And when you're not from a place, so you're not as committed to it. I mean, people treat home a lot differently than they treat hotel rooms.
And to illustrate your point, in the article, you talked about how these things affect you on a regular basis, including some examples of racial profiling that you experience. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I talked about two examples of being pulled over by the police in the 90s. It was called the Blue Blanket. And I went to tell my part-time receptionist that she didn't have to come to work. She was sick. And I was pulled over because the officer asked why I did not go into her house. And I said, well, she's my employee. I'm a male. I'm married. I'm not going to do that. And I just told her she didn't. And I didn't want to catch what she had. And he said, well, it looked like you were setting up for a drug deal and your actions fit the profile of a drug dealer. And I had a black suit on. I was going to take pictures for our church. And that was two blocks from my church. My church is on Badger Road. And this was right at the Park Bank parking lot in broad daylight. It was embarrassing. The second time, I mentioned just a few years ago, I was meeting my associate who's a white gentleman, and he was in our parking lot waiting for us. We have a standing Saturday evening meeting, and he was waiting. And the police pulled me over and said they were looking for someone in a red car. My car's black, and started asking me why was I there and who I was. And so I started showing ID. My white colleague who was sitting there in his car got out, walked over to the police, which I, as an African-American male, would never do, not out of fear of being shot by Madison police. That's not my concern, but being embarrassed or yelled at. Or I just learned you don't do that. When the police pull you over, you put your hands at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel and you answer the questions nicely. He started, you know, engaging in small talk, and they asked him if I was who I said I was. Not once did they ask him why he was there or who he was or if they could see ID. But yet they wanted him to corroborate my identity without even seeing his identity. And so in the story, I mentioned that when my church was broken into in that same parking lot, I described myself to the 911, to the dispatch, just because I didn't want any confusion. I didn't want them to come in after calling about a break-in and thinking that I might be the assailant. So I described my sweater, my jeans, the color, make a mark of my collar of my car, just because I didn't want the frustration and the professional embarrassment of someone coming over asking me who I was and what I was doing there while a guy was downstairs wrecking my church.
Mm. Wow. It sounds like those experiences could make you a little grumpy.
Well, they do. You know what's interesting? And this is what I try to help people to understand. Although I may insinuate that there is some profiling, and I'm sorry, let me back up. I think there's definitely some profiling, whether or not that's solely on race. I'm sure that that's a huge, huge part of it. I never was able to get the officer to say, yes, I pulled you over because you're black. So there's never any proof. That's what I think I'm trying to say. But when the next time that incident happens, it awakens all of the other experiences. So I can put it behind me because you have to be able to function and to be a team member and to not walk around totally violent. So I forget about it until the very next time it happens, and then it all comes back. And I think when I called the police and described myself, and that was just a few months ago, it brought back the other experiences. And I think at that point, I started writing the article in my head.
So the article has gotten a lot of response from people.
It's gotten a lot of response. I mean, writing is not new to me, but I don't really write for newspapers. I mean, I've written a few books, and so it's interesting. You write a book and it's not in print for another year. It's very interesting to write something and it's on the front cover the next week. Cap Times called me over the weekend and told me that it was the top read story. It has more than 4,000 shares. So not hits, but 4,000 shares. And it is by far the leading read article last month. Well, that's flooring me, but I'm receiving all kinds of calls. Strangers are stopping me and introducing themselves to me. And people want to help. People are saying, we hear you. We believe it. What do we do? What can we do to be very helpful? So I have to say, we want to see the action, but the outpouring, the response makes me really proud to be a part of this community.
Wow. Now, you've been a pastor in this area for how long?
Oh, about 28, 30 years.
Now, how come you never brought this up earlier? You said, what sort of motivated you now to do this?
Oh, I talk about it. So yeah. I've written about it. I write about it in the Madison Times. So I've written about it.
Yeah.
What really push buttons for me. And again, this is when I was at Downtown Rotary giving a talk about mass incarceration. And this isn't meant to be a reflection or a poor reflection on Rotary. It's just where I was when things clicked and when the straw broke the camel's back.
Right, right.
And when this woman kept pushing me and congratulating me on not being angry and then started comparing me to other African-American leaders who are my colleagues and friends, I just said, okay, now I'm benign and I'm safe. And then now you want to put a wedge between me and my colleague. And this is the thanks I get for coming and saying what I'm saying. And everyone in that room didn't do that. There was just this one particular woman. But when she did it, I said, all right, I'm going public. And so I called my friend Phil Haslinger, who I knew was a writer. He's a pastor now. He introduced me to Paul Fanland. And I told him the story. And Paul was listening with being cordial. I mean, Paul's a nice guy. I don't know him well. But when I told the part about calling 911 and describing myself, he dropped his head, and when he raised it, he said, I never think of describing myself when I call 911. I want you to write me 3,000 words. I want to put this on the front cover. He just laid everything out. Because I think at that point, he realized I wasn't walking around saying, my food is cold because I'm black. You know, my car gets ticketed because I'm black. It's colder in my house because it's black. I think he realized, all right, whether or not he had to do that, the fact that this man who has served this community from everything as a paper boy to an assistant to David Ward when he was chancellor years ago to a pastor, that if he has to think about describing himself before dialing 911, which is his right as a taxpayer, that's important enough to me that he thinks he has to do it. And Paul said, I want you to write that. So I think it came because of a culmination of things. But I think just trying to prove to someone that I wasn't angry revealed just how angry I was. And I think that was the proverbial straw that broke that camel's back.
Wow. I mean, there was another thing that jumped out in the piece you wrote where somebody said, well, you do have a nice car, you know.
Yes. And I think, and I said at which point I realized that not only was I angry, I was hurt and disillusioned.
Yeah.
Because that was just
so that would
sort
make
of
somebody,
the apex of
somebody think you're a drug dealer because
right.
you have a nice
like,
car.
Like what else would they think, Alex? I'm thinking, wow, my mom moved me here as a single mom going through a divorce and paid for my college tuition. I didn't have any student loans. I lived at home. She paid for my college tuition so I could get a job. My wife and I had no children. I was a University of Wisconsin employee, as was my wife. I could afford a $10,000 car, which is, I mean, I say that joke. That's how much it cost. It was a you know, Chevy Toyota. It was a Nova.
Right.
Yet my friend thought, well, that was a pretty nice, he thought you're driving a pretty nice car. So the guy's just doing his job. Cut him some slack. And it was very sincere. We're friends to this day. That wasn't a mean email or back in those days a fax or a letter.
Right.
He was just trying to help me to make sense of it. It was his way of saying, Alex, it wasn't about race. It wasn't because he was a bad guy. He's protecting the community because people who look like you commit drunk crimes, particularly those with nice cars. And I'm thinking, this is Madison. We probably have more blacks who have degrees than who are drug dealers.
So you've gotten people's attention. And what's next? Yes. What's the next thing? What are you going to do next?
Well, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I saw this coming. I mean, you know, I run a nonprofit, an urban leadership development organization. I pastor a church. I'm doing hospital visits. I'm traveling. I'm a speaker. I did not know that there was going to be this kind of response. I thought it would be on the front cover. You'd be the flavor of the day, and then it'll go away, and then I'll tuck it away in an album and show my grandchildren one day. But now I'm realizing I'll probably have to cut my vacation short, which is all right. I mean, sometimes an opportunity calls you. And I want to spend some time meeting with political leaders. I've had one reach out to me. The county executive called me and said he'd like to talk. I'd like to meet with other elected officials just to say, hey, I have my point of view, and I've got some emotion behind this, but I'm part of this community, and I want to help to bring solutions. I want to bring people to the table who are not normally to the table. I want to listen to disenfranchised folks and hear their story. But I'm also spending time listening to school teachers and concern. Most of the emails I'm getting are from white Madisonians who are saying, we want to do something. How do we help? How do we support? So I want to hear their voices, as well as help to network them in places already established programs and organizations that they can plug into. So I think the next step is really doing a little bit more homework, because this is catching me off guard a bit, but putting together planning teams and having some community events. And I received a call from Cap Times today, and they want to actually host the community forum where I want to, along with community leaders — this is not the Alex G show — with community leaders, make some recommendations for some very solid next steps. We don't want to fall into the typical Madisonian trap of just having other discussions and white papers and coalitions. We want to recommend probably a half dozen doable things that we can take on to the next year, year and a half. So we could say we haven't fixed everything, but we've done something other than talk. And so in the next several weeks to the next month, I want to present some of those things once I've had a chance to really go deeper and have more talks with my cabinet of friends and associates.
Well, Reverend G, thanks so much for coming in today. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate the interview.
Alex G is a pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church, and thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Many of us are tempted by Christmas cookies and other sweet treats this time of year, but our next guest says if you want a health alternative, nuts are where it's at.
Laura Isaacson is a registered dietitian with Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville, and she's here to give tips on turning nuts into a delicious daytime snack. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So it wasn't very long ago that nuts were thought of as a bad thing, and you weren't supposed to eat too many of them, but it seems like things have turned around, huh?
Well, nuts are full of monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats. So those are the healthy fats that are actually good for your heart, and they help to lower your LDL cholesterol, which is your bad cholesterol. So actually including nuts in your diet is good for your heart.
What about the fat? Do we have to worry about the fat in nuts? That's always what you hear sometimes when I say to people, but nuts are healthy, as I'm scarfing down nuts. And they say, right, but they're high in fat.
They are high in fat, but the types of fat that are in nuts are more healthy for you than saturated fats, which are the types of fats in animal products. So it's important to include nuts, but because they are high in fat, they're really high in calories as well. So just be mindful of the portion that you're eating. And an appropriate portion of nuts is 1.5 ounces, which is about a handful. So if you are going to have some nuts, just make sure that you eat about a handful and not much more than that.
See, that's a problem that I have. it's impossible for me to eat a handful of nuts. So, I mean, is that one of the things that's kind of edgy about nuts in general, is that they may be good for you, but people are more inclined to just eat them like crazy?
Right. So what you're going to want to do, rather than just eating nuts out of a big bag or a can of nuts, you should pre-portion them out, maybe into a snack-sized baggie, so that you aren't tempted to eat more than the handful or 1.5 ounces. And so that's a really good idea for a snack. If you just bring along a little baggie of nuts and have that for an afternoon snack, that would be a good way to include nuts without eating too many of them.
In terms of which nuts, you know, you get the most nutritional bang for your buck, which nuts are the healthiest?
Well, all nuts are good for you. Walnuts are important to include in your diet because they contain omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory and also really good for your heart. So walnuts are really good, but probably some of the other healthy nuts would include almonds, hazelnuts, peanuts, pecans, pine nuts, pistachios, and then, of course, walnuts.
Now, this time of year, people put weird things on nuts. They put, like, you know, sugar coatings and stuff like that. Does that have a negative impact on whether nuts are good for you or not?
Absolutely. So when you're choosing nuts, make sure that they aren't covered with chocolate, sugar, salt. All of those types of things are going to make them a little bit more unhealthy for you.
But is it still better than eating, you know, a Christmas cookie if you're eating a chocolate-covered nut?
Probably, yes. In the whole scheme of things, that would probably be better. But if you were doing some baking, for example, and you were making some cookies with maybe some chocolate chips or something else like that in them, you could substitute some of the chocolate for nuts to make them a little bit healthier. And you can add in nuts if you're baking bread or doing any other baked goods this time of year. That would be a good addition to make it a little bit healthier.
So one thing about nuts is, I mean, because they have they have a lot of fiber in them, right?
That's correct.
So is it possible that that could fill you up a little bit more if you're a little slower in your nut eating? I mean, is that part of the reason why people could wind up being healthier when they eat nuts?
Right. So we want to include fiber in our diet. Fiber is very healthy for us, for our digestive tract. If you're trying to lose weight, which most people this time of year are trying to lose a little bit of weight, especially around the new year, fiber helps you to stay full, and fiber also helps to reduce cholesterol. So all foods that are high in fiber are important to include in your diet, and then nuts are a really great source of fiber, so that's another great benefit in addition to the healthy fats. And then another thing I haven't mentioned about nuts is that they are an excellent source of protein.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but okay. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Laura Isaacson, registered dietitian with Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville, talking about the virtues of nuts.
If you have your favorite nut recipe or some convenient snack ideas, you can post them on the Central Time Facebook page.